This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on Saturday, the 28th of September, 2013, on Monocle 24.
An American classic gets a redesign. The Finns turn art dictators, a master behind the lens, and a sartorial critic from the Pink Pages. All that plus a Roman magazine holiday on this 57th edition of The Stack. Today on the programme, we're going in-depth and behind the lens as we learn the art of selling luxury in print, and we'll examine what a man should wear and what he might like to flick through too. We also head to Rome to meet the great and the good of the industry at the World Magazine Congress.
In Q&A sessions and keynote speeches, the subject on everyone's lips was how to go digital. E-readers, apps, and the latest tools to attract viewers to websites.
And at the top end of the continent to Helsinki, where a brash new art magazine launches.
We're kind of trying to achieve something that is different from the traditional art magazines. So it's not only about art, it's more about how to consume art.
All that and much more today here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brilliant. Last week it was Melbourne, and this week we're back at base to close our November issue and gear up for our final production push right through to the end of 2013. And before I get back to pushing pages through upstairs, time to meet our guest. One of them is one of the world's most respected photographers. We have him in the house today, and also a very good journalist too. Let's meet them around the table. Well, it's a bit of a different table configuration here. We're in Studio 2, as we said at the top of the program. And seated off to my left, a name will be very familiar. Anyone who, of course, spends a little time going through magazines, certainly glossy ones, Matthew Donaldson, a photographer and filmmaker. And we were just talking about the filmmaking side a little bit before we went on air here. You're spending London, I guess, spiritual home to some extent, a little bit of Milan, but it sounds like a lot of Los Angeles, and I wanted to just, you know, again, for people, of course, know your name as of course, you know, one of the greats, and been around, certainly, we don't want to say for too long a time, but certainly there's been a good run up to this. What's the filmmaking work? Is it primarily commercial or also personal stuff as well?
It's primarily commercial. We've just finished a long series of adverts for Target, which had been we've been shooting really over the last sort of 14, 15 months. We've done 25, 28 commercials, which has been a fabulous experience. You know, something I've never done anything that big before, and we managed to I think we did a good job. It was exciting, you know, a bit very, very different to being a still life photographer in a room on your own when no one ever wants to come to a shoot with a still life photographer, because it is duller than ditch water for most people. This is a huge sort of event, as anything.
Was that always part of the trajectory in your mind, you know, going from the, you know, the still image and always this desire to you know, to do moving, and particularly at that scale as well?
No, never. I mean, I really considered myself always as a photographer. I really had no interest in moving image. Until I first, I did do one film of a very slow motion film of something which was pretty much a still image moving very, very slowly at 1,000 frames a second. And somebody saw it and liked it and said, would you like to do another one? And, you know, problem solving and is my thing. That's what I like. And someone puts something in front of me, usually I'll have a go at it, and it's been a fantastic experience so far.
And with Target, was this a case of you know, agency being in between, or was it someone sitting on the creative side of you know, of this massive, well, U.S. now increasingly global retail brand that said, you know we like, you know, we really like what, you know, what Matthew does. Let's see if he can, you know, bring this to life in moving image.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was. It's an ensemble thing, you know. Everybody's involved. Obviously, there are original ideas that the agency come up with. They sell them to Target. Target then they say, this is who we would like to do it. We go through all that process of directors and who gets to do the thing. And luckily, you know, we came out and they chose me to do it. And then we move forward together. And it was an enjoyable experience as a client and the agency who are called Mono. in Minneapolis. It seemed pretty painless, you know.
It just, it's an incredible, I mean, when you talk about just A, the time and commitment, but the amount of commercial you had to produce, is that because they're in a rhythm, you know, with the retail cycle in the United States, keeping it fresh, that they want something new out every 2 weeks? Or is this about a compressed Christmas burst, or what is it? It's a lot of film.
No, I think it's a sustained campaign that started airing it around the time of the, not the Oscars, what's the other one? The one before.
Emmys, Grammys.
The one that's in, I can't remember. Anyway, they started at one point about a year ago.
Golden Globes.
Exactly. And they decided to buy, they bought out all the advertising. They had sort of seven of the ads and they bought all the advertising around it. And then I think, you know, the way that they work it is that the products, the people that produce the products actually pay for, you know, they're involved in paying. So then we were doing one for sort of a floor thing, or then another company would want to do one. So it sort of carried on that way. So it was a campaign. I mean, now they're moving on to the next step of the campaign. But I think Target have a very high profile. They want, the stuff is out there all the time. It's not stop and start. You know, it's consistent.
Mm. Also joining us around the table, familiar voice here at the Stack, is Charlie Porter. Stops at Fantastic Man, of course, Guardian as well. And now, sometimes I think you're sharing the same section with me. You're normally sort of, page 4 or 5, and I'm stuck on the back. Yeah. But yes, also at the Financial Times. Only weekend as well, or also are you doing, if there's major reporting to be done during the week as well?
It's only during the men's shows. My title is Men's Fashion Critic, so it's kind of a dream title because it's not a job. There's no kind of stuff to be done.
There's no confined humdrum space for it.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
Well.
Yeah, and it's a set pattern of like 4 or 5 weeks of a year where there's the build up, then the shows, then the kind of talk afterwards. So it's kind of perfect.
And it's interesting that you've got this sort of confined space. And does that mean it is the world of New York? I guess a little bit of London, Paris and Milan, but also with a global brand like the FT, where you're also seeing other fashion weeks and other markets trying to sort of at least make an attempt to enter the calendar.
It's not so much. Well, the men's world is obviously like a long way behind women's wear in terms of the schedule. So New York at the moment has no men's fashion week to speak of. I think they're trying to want to make one happen. London is the one that's really happened in the last year. So it's London, then Milan, then Paris. Actually, it's not so much other fashion weeks. It's more other countries buying or owning brands in those countries. Like in London, one of the big stories was Gives, and it's Trinity, I think, from Hong Kong, who now own Gives. And so it's a Hong Kong-based conglomerate buying out bits of South Row and actually doing quite a good job in attempting to make a contemporary idea of the thing that everyone wants to survive, but no one quite knows how to make survive. The interesting thing for me in the FT, obviously the reader is a businessman in some respects, but also I'm allowed, and it allows me to write about the things I'm interested in, which is new young designers as well, and I haven't even had to argue it with them. It just kind of happens. Mm. And because in London especially, there's the balance between the two, that I can write in the same review about Gives and Hawks and then go on about Craig Green, who's this young kid who does planks of wood in front of people's faces, which has been this massive kind of tabloid scandal, like he calls. And the way I always think about it is that if the FT were to write about a tech brand, they'd be interested in startups. It's not just the old business that they want. It's got an interest in the kind of news. So it's a really nice, I don't have to justify what I'm doing. Obviously, I have to think about the reader and think, okay, I can't be too
right.
I have to put in some context, but I'm also allowed to be critical about
it. But don't you think that there is there's room to also let that bleed out for the other 46 weeks of the year as well? Because it's always, it's the performance of Coach and let's say, how does Target perform and all of these other people. And as you said, and I like that analogy of the fashion startup, alongside the tech one. The tech startup, they're there every single day of the week. Now, maybe there's not as much to say about men's, or maybe there is. Do you think there's a tension there that you would like to see, not to carve out more space for yourself, of course, but on the other side as well, it seems that this is of course a market, and all eyes from China to acquire things in this country too.
I think it's fascinating the way that menswear is. It's really interesting. Menswear is this thing which seems like it's a million miles away from womenswear. I actually think it's both behind and ahead, because womenswear seems quite stuck in a rut of kind of cocktail dresses and niceness. Whereas menswear is actually relating to what men wear, And most women I know don't wear cocktail dresses. They wear what they wear. And it's this weird, there is a real weird tension around it. And also because we're stuck at the moment still with the show system, which obviously should end because it has nothing to do with the way stores buy or the way that people wear clothes or, you know, the spring, summer going on sale in January and all that stuff. But we're stuck with it at the moment. So there's a lot of change to happen in the next few years.
I mean, all that said, though, it's remarkable, though. You know, shows roll into town, and you know, whether it's the FT or the IHT, there's also this you know, this interesting. We sort of talk about the Trinity, but you know, the relationship between, you know, the shows and those major newspapers still. And I'm just wondering, if, you know, from your point of view, where you're also sort of, you know, very involved, not just of course with established press, Charlie, but also you know certainly with startups as well in media. In general, what's happening, you know, front row, second row right now around the shows? You know, there was so much excitement about, you know, all of these, you know, 4-year-old bloggers, and, you know, who could balance, you know, 50 laptops and you know, be reporting in real time. I go to one or two shows a year. It feels like sort of the heat is off a little bit.
The 4-year-old blogger thing was a moment a few years ago. That's kind of stopped the thing. That was more, and that was actually quite bad. A lot of the brands exploited that and kind of invited the bloggers to sit front row, and then it was obviously they can't sustain themselves because they've got to grow up as a teenager or whatever.
Go to school.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that thing's died down. The thing I find about fashion writing, there's something about it which is very similar to kind of restaurant reviews in a way. Like there are these things in the paper or in magazines, but especially papers, where you don't necessarily go to that restaurant. I don't go to the restaurants, but I obsessively read them. Mm. And actually, I'm obsessed with reading the New York Times restaurant review. I think Pete Wells is amazing. And I read it religiously every Wednesday morning. I click to see what it is. I've never heard of most of them, but there's something convivial about writing about restaurant. And I think fashion can have that same connection. You don't necessarily have to buy from the brand, wear the brand, but there's some sort of human nature thing about the subject.
Gentlemen, we're talking to Matthew Donaldson, the photographer and, of course, filmmaker as well now, and also journalist Charlie Porter. You're listening to The Stack. We are going away for a very short break. We're back in a moment. And welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Our guests around the table today, we have Matthew Donaldson, the photographer, and also journalist Charlie Porter. We're going to be coming back to you gentlemen in a moment, of course, to look at what you've brought in to discuss and dissect. But first, over to Rome. Every industry needs a big global conference for delegates to meet, talk business, and thrash out some of the key issues. And this, together with an infinite supply of canapes and fizz, is what took place for the magazine industry this week in the Italian capital. The FIPP World Magazine Congress has built up a reputation of being the global meeting point for executives from all the major groups and their business partners. Earlier, we managed to tear FIPP CEO Chris Llewellyn away from the Prosecco on the terrace, and I quizzed him on the industry outlook and whether the big titles are losing some of their innovative shine.
I think there's a realisation that the industry has gone through some profound change, but the mood I'm getting from the delegates here has been, I think, helped enormously by certainly the position in September, where a lot of magazines in the big lifestyle markets have actually had remarkably good trading. I mean, the American publishers are talking about their September issues, those big fashion issues, have actually produced record amounts of advertising. So that sort of buoyed the spirit. I think also people have come together here, you know, they're coming from all over the globe to share experiences, and there's a lot of positive case stories being exchanged, if you like. Now, that's sort of masking the fact that underlying it, it's really hard, and pretty much everywhere circulations are under pressure. But I think people sort of are getting to grips with what they have to do to change, and it's fairly obvious. You've got a trend where the print circulation is declining, and they've got to innovate and bring in new businesses, increasingly digital businesses, but not entirely, to compensate. And there's a bit of a lag because the revenues are being lost and not being replaced as quickly enough. But I think the feeling people've got here is that's just a timing issue. And if we can get through the next 2 years, you know, from 2015 onwards, I think they're expecting to see real growth in their overall revenues.
Do you think we're also in a bit of a settle-down period as well? We come back to this frequently at Monocle because you talk to a lot of companies on one side who want, of course, just peddle digital products. You talk to paper suppliers and manufacturers on really at the extreme at the other end. And then in the middle, of course, are all of the editors, the publishers who have to get their print titles out. They have to do something digitally. And it seems latest round of ABC figures, for example, in the UK reveal, you know, not a lot of great news, but there, you know, there are some bright sparks in print. But also what it's shown also digitally is that it's not all that great, that there hasn't been this fantastic rush to tablets. And it's interesting how you mention, you know, certainly this wonderful September that a lot of glossy titles all over the world have had. You know, people for those times, they still want print. And we see a lot of tablet sales, you know, are not particularly good. So do you think, you know, many are thinking, you know, actually, let's stay on this course. If we're going to give people a print product, then let's give them something really great. And we might put our digital efforts somewhere else.
I think a great print project is a non-negotiable. You must have that. It's still going to be the heart of the brand for some time to come. I mean, I think I disagree with the feeling on the digital products. I think people know the take-up, it will be slower because we're learning about the new digital newsstand techniques. You know, whether you sell single issues or subscriptions, or the bundle or unbundle, whether the price is cheaper than print or more expensive than print, we're taking baby steps in understanding digital retailing. I think that's a matter of timing too. I think the other thing people are learning, what digital can do, it can lead you down many of the revenue avenues that you may not have considered. Just had a session on e-commerce where people are starting to do some really interesting things. L in Japan with their L shop is now got a significant amount of digital revenue. So it's not, digital isn't just all about tablet editions, digital editions. It's about the relationship and the consumer, those commercial relationships you have across the piece. The digital revenue prize will come not just from selling magazines.
And that was CEO of the FIPP World Magazine Congress, Chris Llewellyn, and we'll be hearing a little bit more from the Congress in this program. But first, a short break. We're back after this.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shubiken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
And you're with The Stack here on Monocle 24. Today I'm joined by Matthew Donaldson, photographer, and also Charlie Porter, journalist. And of course, he said at the top of the program, he likes being known as a men's fashion critic at the Financial Times.
That's kind of, people, if, when people ask what I do, it's kind of, that's the only thing that I can actually say what I do. So it's kind of, I say it, but I don't really know what I do.
Well, it's good. We're at Critique Corner at this part of the program, and just having heard from, of course, the World Magazine Congress a little bit earlier. Both of my guests have been very obedient. There's lots to look at. You've got the New Yorker there. You've got Freezer. There's all kinds of things. Where do you want to start?
Well, at the top is the New Yorker, which I've bought in the last two issues. Mm. Because since the style issue, which was the last week, they did a redesign, and it was such big news. There was actually a story about it in the New York Times. The fact that they'd redesigned. The redesign is the front section, mm-hmm. and it's fascinating both in terms of like. It changes so little, the fact they've actually done one, but also because the front section is a listing called Goings On About Town, and it's to deal with the fact that people don't need listings anymore, but then also it's a core part of the magazine that, in the same way I was saying about restaurant reviews before, right. I love reading Goings On About Town because I love knowing what's on at the Met in New York. And it's the way they've tried to deal with it is by introducing larger photos. So the first page of the section is a full page image, and then they've changed size of type, they've introduced a new font. I'm not an expert on this, I think it's called Irwin. I've got another copy.
Love to.
I think, is this Irwin here?
I don't know.
I know we have to get someone down from upstairs.
But basically, the editor Dave Remnick said that he wants it to be that if you saw a copy of the magazine across the room, you would still think it's the New Yorker. So there's no radical change, but there's change. I have mixed feelings about it because
I was going to say I'm hearing shortchanged in your voice.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was great as it was because it's kind of it's the thing of New York is you want New York to be New York and you want to read all that stuff. The reality of modern magazines is the front section is basically stuff to sit next to single page ads.
Correct.
And so the single page ad has to look good to please the advertiser, and the stuff next to it has to look different enough from the ad. Mm. Immediately the opening spread doesn't. You can't see. If you were to flick through that, you'd think that was another advert.
Yeah.
So immediately it fails because you don't see that as the fine page.
Mm. And there's something, you know, when you go back to the review and listings component of it, I think for people who live all over the world, because in so much popular culture, it launches, it breaks first in the US. So that was also the wonderful thing. The New Yorker is truly global, because if you read that review first, there's a good chance that film's not going to open in London for another 3 or 4 weeks. Or if it's something from an obscure film festival, you may not see it for half a year. So do you feel that those elements, though, all people who love the New Yorker, that's why we go there, is that still fulfilled?
It's still fulfilled mostly, yeah. I mean, I'm sure after about 6 months it'll be completely normal to me. But the one thing they've done is they've removed some of the listings about museums and galleries, which actually I used to like those pages too. The design of it, rather than it being a consistent flowing listing, they've got a leg, which is the term, isn't it? Is that right? So when a page, if there's columns, and then the final column, if it runs short, they actively want it to run short as a design, so there's like a white gap at the bottom. So design has come into it, rather than it being a flowing listing. I actually think it's not just the thing about the information that you get from it. I think that the New Yorker and the New York Times, they're allowed to celebrate the city that they're in.
Mm.
And there's something joyous about reading about listings where you feel like you can be part of that.
Can you just pass that across?
Sure.
Because it is interesting, I think, also when you talk about, this is the style issue, there are going to be sort of more full bleeds. And I wonder, just with sort of the rethink of what that's done for fractionals, as well, because I'm looking just up front right now, and I'm trying to get towards the back. There's all of those sort of the small bitty ads that we like. They're still there, but actually there seems to be less of them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this one, this week's one is, see, like, because that's Perfect Bound, because it's a style issue, so it's the twice a year. Every so often have a Perfect Bound one for thicker issues, but this is with Staple, this week's one.
Mm.
And so these are called fractionals then. This is what I know. Do you mean the smaller adverts?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they were going across two columns. I mean, they are in the back, but I don't know, there's not, and of course, maybe it's a style issue, so that, they don't have to worry about revenue quite as much.
But, the contents page has changed as well. So straight away we're into the contents, which is a half page, and then, again, the opening spread of Girls About Town again is a full bleed image, which looks like the ad for Citibank, a credit card next to it.
Why have they changed it? I don't understand why they've changed. And they have, obviously, you said they've only changed the front section.
It's only the front section.
And the rest is the good old New Yorker. But I don't see what they're gaining. I don't. Why did they do it?
It's always been an issue with the New Yorker about how to move forward. Mm. Like, I mean, they only introduced. Is it colour photos or photos themselves in 1992? There's some really weird. Like, I think just photography itself, wasn't it?
Was it colour?
I think
you're right. It was maybe it was photography.
And so it doesn't change. Mm. And maybe they just feel like to them. I think also. I mean, it's true. They also said they wanted to celebrate their critics a bit more.
I'm happy that my favorite ad that is still here. One of the fractionals in the back, which is "Retire to Farington, a charming country village near Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with bluebirds, belted cows, and fascinating people of all ages." It's a place
I hope we all end up there.
Right. I'm thinking we very well might. Yeah. So if you had to score this, Charlie,
Front section six.
A six.
I mean,
it's not an outright fail.
Yeah. But they're both really. They look. But they're really good issues. So I'm looking forward to actually. Obviously, the New York thing. I haven't had a chance to read them yet. But
no,
they're on the pot of I will. I promise.
Well, we should probably stay in the same stable, because I think you've got the September issue of Vogue there. I guess. Clearly October issue is already out. But yeah, it's great because we haven't had. No one's really sort of dived into it, and it's a beast.
I'm sort of dumbfounded. I mean, this. It starts on page 761.
The well
of the magazine with two three fashion stories and a profile. There are four set fashion stories, and that's Vogue, and it's what we expect, and it's great. It looks shining. I'm just fascinated by this enormous amount of advertising. Yeah. I mean, it's like that's the magazine. That's, you know, Charlie and I were talking about it earlier. But I mean, this is the entertainment, isn't it? This is the. It's almost like the magazine is just tacked on the back of this huge brick of advertising.
No, and I mean, in one of our earlier reports as well, there was at this, of course, major magazine conference in Rome. You know, the talk has been it's turned out to be quite a good autumn for, you know, a lot of print titles who are of course in this glossy arena. So, you know, many others are having a tough time of it, but certainly there must be some very happy people sitting at Condé Nast Towers in New York.
I'm fascinated with this by how they order it, because in a magazine there's a definite hierarchy of adverts. Like, people have a brand will command the first spread and the second spread, and there's a definite order to it. And if you work on a glossy magazine, you get to know what that order is. But in this, how they do it, like how they decide who goes where, and then sometimes, so we're looking through the opening now, and we've just had like Ralph Lauren, Prada, Dior, so it's good. And then after about like 100 pages or something, you suddenly start getting some really weird, less good ones. And then suddenly it picks up again. Like, how do they, I mean, it's quite a way, it's about 200 pages in, they start getting a bit sort of like, you know, Macy's,
right?
You know, good old Macy's, but Nine West Shoes,
right?
And you think, oh, okay, so we've gone through. You think, oh, we've gone through the glossy glosses, and then suddenly you're back to Valentino because it's around the contents page. And
it's
very sort of like there's hills and peaks and troughs of what they do. Rolex,
in seeing sort of Rolex actually, you know, quite late when Rolex, you know, love a back cover and they want an opening spread.
But then you go suddenly to True Religion jeans and an advertorial for H&M, and it goes down again, and something called NY, you know, these things are obviously, they stuff it with ads who are just desperate to be in. And then we're back to Todd's, and you can read the adverts in it. It's fascinating.
You can only imagine the sort of diplomacy and politics involved in that.
Yeah,
everyone totally. Who goes where. Can you imagine the lunches and dinners and
wait, I can't even emails. Imagine managing the flat plan for this. You've marked out a couple of pages. Just before we sort of crack the spine again, editorially, right now, Matthew, what are your major ports of call?
I'm sort of confused about what my major ports are. I mean, I've taken a while off making films, and I'm sort of now hoping to get back into still photography again. So I'm sort of been sumped the summer and the fall, and now I'm just sort of buying magazines again and just talking about what we want to do. But I think that the world of the editorial photographer has changed so enormously over the last, you know, 5-10 years, 2 years, you know, the budget's being slashed so much. It's I mean, you never really did editorial photography to make money. That was never an incentive. It was other things. But now there's money. It doesn't even figure in it at all. You can literally, you know, you're looking at to do the stories that you want to do, and trying to place them with the magazine you want them to be at. I mean, it used to be the phone would ring up and say, would you like to do 8 pages on, I don't know, men's brogues or something, and and that would be exciting, and it's still exciting, but it's the 8 pairs of men's brogues that you're given, and perhaps not always the ones that you want to photograph, or, you know, the whole thing is much, much more difficult. So I think I, you know, personally looking more at stories that are driven by, you know, that are my own stories and things that I'm really interested in, and then trying to convince the magazines that I work with or that I like or that I want to work with to get involved and run them, because, you know, they're not going to give you it. You know, there's going to be no money involved.
Really. Does the budget you're given jeopardize the quality of the shoot? I mean, is there enough money to actually do a good enough shoot?
I think it really does. You get to the point where really it whatever you're being given as a budget actually sort of begins to bear no relation to the work that you're doing.
So you're expected to give pay for it yourself.
Yeah, you can't
even look at
that.
Being in the,
and maximum. I've got over the sort of period of being dismayed or angry or whatever at that. It's just that is now the way it is, you know. Let's not pretend it's any other way. So now it's just, as always, to try and do the best work you possibly can, and if you can afford to, you know, do that by subsidizing it from other work and things, then it's still worth doing. But I think one needs to be more careful.
Well, I want to go back to the carefully marked pages with the very nice green posters after this, though. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
Somalia has been a failed state for more than 2 decades, and if it's going to recover, then the airport in Mogadishu will play a key role.
Just a few years ago, the airport was nothing more than a military airbase and a target for mortars fired from nearby neighbourhoods that were under the control of Islamic insurgents. Now, there are daily scheduled passenger flights. But if you're not familiar with Somalia, then you'll still be in for a shock. This is not Heathrow, nor Schiphol. It's Mogadishu, and while things are getting better, the improvement is relative.
Words by Tristan McConnell, images by Pete Muller. Photo reportage at its best. Now playing on Monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where it's also time to head back to Rome, where earlier this week, the city hosted the FIPP World Magazine Congress. Given the digital offering has exploded in recent years and news can now be delivered to readers on a host of devices, big and small, publishers and editors have been scrambling to find out ways to perfect this new format and, of course, how to make money. In Rome, the topic was front and center at the Congress. Speakers from leading media companies gave their take on how best to make the marriage of old and new media work on paper and, of course, on the backlit screen. Our correspondent from Milan, we put him on the Freccia Rossa, Ivan Carvalho, to report from the event.
This week, the Eternal City was the setting for a gathering of some of publishing's leading lights. In Q&A sessions and keynote speeches, the subject on everyone's lips was how to go digital. E-readers, apps, and the latest tools to attract viewers to websites. Still, despite impressive slideshows and pitches for software, much of the talk turned back to the industry's most reliable product, the printed word. Jyrki Ovska is president of Finland's UPM, the world's leading maker of magazine paper.
Print still plays an extremely important role. It is deeply embedded in our culture. People love to, you know, have, you know, the tactile properties, the lean back, personal touch that actually only print can deliver in its form, and it still is a very, very highly effective advertising medium. From the magazine publishers' advertising revenue, up to 80 to 90% of their revenues is still derived from print. So even if there's a lot of talk about the digital transformation, it still is in its infancy when it comes to money making. I think that print appeals to several senses. That's one of the strengths of print. That's the reason why. For advertisers also, it's a very effective medium because people remember the ads in printed form better than they do in television, radio, or even web. And there are plenty of studies that is saying that.
Publishers were eager to learn from each other's forays into how best to build a digital readership if they were careful about experiments with social media and editors losing sight of their main job, making great content. Duncan Edwards is CEO of Hearst Magazines International.
Digital revenue for print publishers and for companies like us represents between 10% and 30% of our revenues in different countries. So there's no question that digital revenue is becoming increasingly important, but I continue to think, as I said in my talk yesterday, that we have to continue to look after what we've got, and the job of creating and improving print magazines is never over. I always ask my management to assess how good their magazines are, both relatively compared to their competitors and absolutely compared to the expectations of consumers. And unless you can demonstrate that you win on all levels, you know, the job isn't finished. So I think publishers have this double responsibility to continue to manage and look after what we've got, which is highly profitable and, you know, much loved by consumers, whilst continuing to innovate and develop digital products. And it's not really an either-or question. You have to do both.
On social media, now, sometimes magazines like to involve their readers, get feedback. Is that always a good thing in terms of a magazine has an editorial direction, has a perspective, a point of view?
In today's world, consumers expect to be able to participate in the media that they choose. And you can see that on YouTube, you can see that on Instagram in huge numbers. And I think people will continue to want the point of view of great editors and great photographers, but they'll also want to make their own point of view, and they make their own point of view known. And I think the barriers between those two things are blurring. And that's fine, as long as it's clear what is made professionally and what's made by users, and many of the users are fantastically talented. So I'm very relaxed about the blurring of those lines. What I do think is that conversation and that discussion should take place on our sites, not on Twitter or on Facebook. I think we need to bring our communities into our world rather than sending them out to feed other people's businesses. And so, you know, I feel very, very strongly about building communities within our own environments. I think there's a great example in Finland. So mycosmo.fi, fantastic example where the five best fashion and beauty bloggers in Finland are now part of the team of Cosmo. So all of their blogs and all of their audience appear on mycosmo.fi, and then consumers, you know, other users can add their own photographs in a very Instagram-y kind of way to supplement the professional bloggers and the professional editors. And it's a fantastic thing.
Some presenters, meanwhile, touted recent launches in print. François Coruzzi of France's Lagardère Active was celebrating the new Australian edition of Elle magazine. He sees online and print happily coexisting, with digital just another tool in a company's arsenal to attract readers.
As you know, it's very difficult today to monetize the social media. So what we see with social media is these are ways for us to talk about a brand, to create buzz around the brand, and also to drive traffic to the website, to the magazine. If you, for example, in Australia, we have the magazine cover has been disclosed on the social medias a week before the launch. So it's a way of us to create buzz and to drive readers to buy the magazine and people to go to the website. What is very important is that today we are not selling a magazine, we are not selling Elle, we are a brand. When we say a brand, it's magazine, it's the website, tablet, the social network. But not only, it's also events, it's books, CDs. We do with Elle, we have a very important line of accessories, fashion, decoration, so e-commerce. So that's for us the next step for development. We have to stretch as much as possible the branding, not only in medias, but in whatever can be possible around the world.
Despite the digital revolution well underway, with Facebook likes and Twitter followers on editors' watch list, attendees at the World Magazine Congress left with a feeling that traditional media is here to stay. In Rome, for Monocle, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
And that was our Milan correspondent in Rome, Ivan Carvalho, reporting from the World Magazine Congress. You're at the Stack, back right after this. And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where today my guests are Matthew Donaldson, the photographer and filmmaker, and journalist Charlie Porter. But next, we're heading up to Helsinki, where the debut issue of glossy annual FAT, that's F-A-T, is hitting newsstands for the first time. Showcasing a selection of Finland's budding young artists, the colorful large format magazine that has a bit of a nod to the face, I have to say, covers topics from painting to photography to sculpture and performance, all with the desire to becoming the key English language voice in the nation's lively art scene. We sent our correspondent Josh Fennert up to the capital of Finland.
From the foyer of Helsinki's Neo-Gothic Design Museum, the rain outside has done little to dampen the spirits of the crowds attending the launch of FAT magazine. As the colourful cocktails begin to flow, I catch up with the magazine's editorial team to see why they're devoting valuable time and column inches to Finland's young artists.
So, hello, my name's Pekka Toivonen. I'm the art dictator of FAT magazine. We're here at the Helsinki Design Museum launching the magazine. FAT comes from the words Finnish art today, but actually we have created our genre. FAT is the first art and life magazine. We're kind of trying to achieve something that is different from the traditional art magazines. So it's not only about art, it's more about how to consume art. We're Finns, so we kind of just do what we do. I think one of the points when we started creating this concept was that we want to be honest, because that's kind of what we Finns are. You know, we just wanted to do something with the artist that we'll feature. It's not a promotion thing, it's more like we just wanted to dig all the best in Finnish art and make it a magazine.
We've spoken about some of the kind of engaging fun stuff, some of the ways in which people might pick it up and find it entertaining. But when it comes down to it, running a magazine can be quite an expensive thing to do. How does the kind of funding aspect of it work?
Well, we got this grant from the Ministry of Culture and Education, and they just trusted our professional standards, and like that it's kind of a project of our own, and of course we have to like also look for other kind of funding, and yeah, it takes a lot of money, but it also takes a lot of time. So we're just magazine artists, we just want to make the best possible magazine, and I'm happy to know that the second issue will for sure come next year. This is going to be a yearly show, and we'll see hopefully the third and the fourth and the fifth as well.
I'm Jonathan Mander. My title in this magazine was the text designer, so I worked with a lot of the kind of end bits of the kind of putting all the words together and making it sound good.
So most people listening won't have read the magazine yet. It's only launching today. Can you give us an idea about what's under the covers, what we can sort of expect from it?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, how we've wanted to make it a fun read, we don't expect everybody to know the artist we're writing about or photographing or whatever. There's a concept behind every article. So Pilvi Takala, Finnish artist, we went to meet her in Berlin. We gave her €120 and asked her to spend it in 120 minutes. Because that kind of tied in with the way she does her art. She always does these kind of interventions where she does something good, but it might make you feel a little uneasy before you realize that it's actually a positive thing. So we did a similar thing with her, and a lot of her works have to do with money as well. And then we took two of the most prominent sculptors in Finland, Pekka Jylhä and Pekka Kauhanen, who share the brilliant first name with our art dictator. We took them in a mobile sauna to have a sauna next to one of their most famous pieces, well, the other guy's one of his most famous pieces. So there's always kind of an easy in for the person who doesn't necessarily know who the hell is Pekka Kauhanen. But of course, there's also the other side that for Finns reading it, who might know, is like, everybody knows him. It's still an interesting read.
Launching a print product in an era of backlit screens and free subscriptions is a gutsy move. But FAT's commitment to the physical extends beyond the covers of its first issue. I caught up with the magazine's art curator, Laura Kornicker, to talk through the exhibition she put together to accompany the magazine's launch.
We opened an exhibition last week where you can see three different video works, sculptures, and one textile piece. And all the artists have similar background. They're all not from Helsinki. They're all from Tampere, which is the second largest city in Finland. And the idea was that we present an exhibition by young artists who are not sort of FAT qualified yet. But they, from our point of view, are something that would be famous abroad in a few years. So we believe in them and we want to follow how they continue working as an artist.
You've decided to make it a physical magazine. It's going to be distributed around the world, so it's not in Finnish, it's in English. How did you come to that decision, and was it ever going to be a magazine that was just in Finnish?
Yeah, the starting point was that we only want to publish it in English, because we think that the audience in Finland would be so narrow if it would be in Finnish, and we think that being bilingual would be much more difficult than being only English. And then we want to reach as many people as possible.
The magazine's creative quartet aren't the only ones who are passionate about promoting Finland's art scene. As well as the throngs of guests thumbing the freshly printed pages, the magazine's message also struck a chord with the Design Museum's curator, Suvi Salonyemi.
As a Finnish design museum, our role is to represent, of course, like collect Finnish design and represent Finnish design heritage. But of course, we are responsible of representing what's happening today, and especially we want to offer a platform for creative practices and maybe even surprising outcomes happening today.
Fueled by the optimism of its editors and the vitality of Finland's art scene, FAT magazine brings a refreshingly confident voice to an industry all too often characterized by caution. For Monocle, in Helsinki, I'm Josh Fennett.
And Charlie, you were the first one to at least be thumbing through the pages of FAT. What do you make of it?
I'm quite nervous about it in that they seem to be imposing an idea of what art is. There's not a quietness about it that allows the art to the artists are just kind of happen.
And is that from a layout point of view?
It's straight away from the fact that there's someone called an art dictator. Like, they seem to actually want to intervene and almost be part of it. And it feels slightly like they're trying to make a point rather than just letting something happen. And I think the art writing or art itself just needs to be allowed to happen. It's why there's white spaces in galleries, because then things happen within them.
Nothing, what do you?
I agree completely with Charlie. I think it's, you know, if you buy into this, it's great, but it's one view. It's one distinct view of whatever they happen to be talking about in these things, and it seems very difficult. I mean, I'm only just briefly looking through it now, but it seems to have its own agenda. And I want a bit more freedom, really. Right. I want to be able to, it's almost like I'm being told what to think.
Yeah, the artists should be respected a bit more, and that they should be allowed some sense. I don't really feel like I've got any sense of who any of them are. It all kind of blurred into one.
No, thing. And it all sort of sits into a sort of fashion clique of their thing. And it, you know, I mean, it happens to look quite Jürgen Teller-ish, the whole thing. I mean, that's the world that they like, and that's nothing wrong with that at all. But it would be nice if it was broader and looser. Yeah. Maybe and give me a chance to make my mind up.
Hopefully they've got a second issue on the horizon. Yeah. I know you've got to freeze over there, and whether there's a bridge to that discussion or not.
Yeah, this arrived in the post this morning. That's where it was, and it's a particularly important freeze because it's the October issue, and in 2 weeks' time, 3 weeks' time, freeze sets. I mean, they're probably already building their tent.
I think tents are being pitched immediately right now.
And so this is the issue where, I mean, freeze week has come to dictate London art, the London art year, and so all galleries, the show they have on in October is their most important show. It really kind of helps because it's when all the collectors are here. So I love the October issue of Frieze just for the adverts. And we were talking about reading adverts in Vogue. You actually do read the adverts in Frieze because the opening spread isn't an image. It's a list from Marion Goodman Gallery in New York of the places where her artists around the world are exhibiting. So it's this completely anal list of Tasta Dean's got a show in Santander in Spain and in Rio de Janeiro, should you want to travel there. And also White Cube as well, listing their shows. This is kind of what I was saying about the freedom. Like, it's kind of impossible to have an exhibition in an image quite often when the adverts appear before the exhibition is finished.
Right.
So there is a kind of like curiosity and freedom to the adverts that go into Frieze. I find them fascinating. And also, as well, the fashion adverts that come into Frieze. One of the few places that Eddie Slimane is advertising Saint Laurent is in Frieze.
Right.
And there's this bank here, then there's Raf Dior. You will see Raf on the opening day buying art at Frieze. He's always there. And there's Louis Vuitton, and then there's Alexander McQueen. Yeah, and back to what happened.
It's curious how they go into this fashion. Well, what do you make of news that we hear now that, you know, there will be an art bazaar, Harper's Bazaar, you know, it moves into the art world now.
In what way that this news has passed me by? How
when we were interesting talking to the head of FIP in Rome a little bit earlier, but you know, just that this is space moving to it. And I saw a billboard the other day as I went by, and it was like, you know, art bizarre now as
right,
well. And
okay.
So, do you think that is just a simple... I mean, you're stopping on Celine. There's a Celine ad there.
And which is actually a Jürgen Teller campaign. The interesting thing about... there is a definite link here for the brands in that Frieze Week is one of the busiest weeks of the year in stores. Mm. Like, they know that they will make a lot of money in that week in October when everyone's in town and needs something to wear suddenly for a gala things.
But is it quite simplistic for someone at Hearst to think, let's move in, let's go and do an art version of this because, oh, I see Celine is putting their ads in Frieze?
I think there's a general sort of curiosity about why there's this world that they're not able to, they've not yet exploited and how they can exploit it. Mm. And there's a...
Does it mean, Matthew, you have to pick your battles? Of course, fine to extend brands and everything. I'm a little bit skeptical that if I'm serious about my art, or even if I'm semi-serious, do I go to Bazaar? Do I go to Harper's Bazaar?
What are they proposing? Is it a one-off? Is it a yearly magazine? Surely not.
Everyone sort of talks about a one-off and hope that they turn it into some other kind of franchise, I guess. But yeah,
I wonder why I would pick that magazine up. I mean, maybe they've got an extraordinary team and they've got this amazing idea and they're going to unleash it. And this time next year, we'll be singing its praises. I don't know until one sees it. But I think that the fashion art world is becoming more, they're becoming entrenched in each other more and more and more. And I'm not sure whether it's diluting the art or it's enforcing the fashion. I don't know. They're almost becoming you almost can't tell the difference between the two now. And obviously, there are lots of people that are involved, as you've just mentioned, heavily in fashion, who are heavily involved in art. You know, from Marc Jacobs. That's what he spends his money. You know, they're all doing it, and it's like the artists want to be the fashion designers, and the fashion designers want to be the artists. The photographers want to be artists, and everyone wants to be a photographer.
I think the interesting thing, though, is that art still maintains. I mean, obviously, everyone complains about Frieze and whatever. I'm quite evangelical. I love Frieze as a thing because I take my nieces and nephews there, and these kids get to see this art they never see. But there isn't a thing about art which retains its kind of purity, in the sense that I'm just flicking through and I've just seen there's an advert for a Paul Tech show at Pace London, which I didn't know about, and I'm obsessed with him, and I'll go there straight away after this. You know, it's there still is a sort of, whereas the fashion advert over the page for Max Mara with a woman walking away from me in a padded coat with a fur shawl, this is obviously trying to tell me a much more complex message.
Yeah. Indeed,
absolutely.
Some kind of odd riff on Shibuya Crossing. Just very quickly before we go, I do want to go back to those Mark Pages and Vogue. We're not going to get to any of the other titles you brought. Was there anything sort of specific that you wanted to talk about aside from not getting to the well till page 742?
I mean, there's not really. I mean, I just picked out that I happened to, you know, this morning was just picking out things that I liked. I mean, just generally that and Hedy Slimane comes up again I imagine he took these pictures for Saint Laurent.
Yeah,
and I think he's pretty fantastic, actually. I mean, it's you know, he's poacher turned gamekeeper, whatever you want to say. I mean, he does it really, really well. I mean, I'm still not that I have as much of too much of an interest, but I just still, probably because I'm so old, I can't believe that Eve has gone from Saint Laurent.
Well, the thing is, that is actually a font that they used, that Saint Laurent himself used. So
But his name is gone.
Well, it still is. They still have that logo somewhere.
The YSL
it still lives.
It still lives somewhere. But Saint Laurent Rive Gauche was the original name for Rive Gauche. So so Yves Saint Laurent wasn't the name of the brand. It was Saint Laurent.
Oh, I see. So he's gone back to back to something.
Yeah.
Well, God, he's done something else good too. I mean, I can't. You know, I don't know him. I've never met him. But I think that I've got a suit that he made for Dior about 10 years ago that I bought, and I'm definitely bigger than I was 10 years ago. But for some reason, it still fits.
It's the cut. It's the secret of Saint Laurent. It's the secret
of
the main. It's everyone. It's the secret of the main.
I mean, you know, I've got fatter. I've got thinner. Yeah. I've worn it all the way through, and people, that's a great suit. Yeah. Where'd you get that from?
Well, at least Eve lives on, and much more. We have to leave it there. Matthew Johnson, thank you very much for being on the program. Charlie, always good to see you. Just quickly though, one more thing. I saw you've got something. A little newspaper sitting over here.
This is Ace Hotel in Shoreditch, which just opened. The restaurant next door is called Hoi Polloi, and it's from David Waddington and Pablo Flack of Bistrotech.
Yeah.
And actually, the soft launch is today. And the menu is a print newspaper, which will be every week. And I'm doing the back page. So I'm doing kind of like just local weird stuff.
And they're going to crank this out every single week?
Every single week. I'm up in the production already. But no, I find it fascinating to do. I love doing things that are local. I love doing things that are kind of international and then doing something really small and...
The dimensions of a table.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Again, Matthew Johnson and Charlie Porter. Our producers today, David Pleasant, and our program was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And of course, behind the glass here in Studio 2, we've had Claire Urban manning the deck. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. Remember, you can, of course, catch up with us anytime via our time shift, of course, which is on monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, for me, Tyler Berlay, have a good afternoon. Goodbye.